afternoon, we are pleased to have with us four very qualified scholars of Gnosticism. Dr. Jonathan Grothy of Concordia Seminary, Mr. Greg Lockwood of St. Louis University, Mr. Tim Endine, and Dr. David Deagle. And each speaker will give a presentation of about 15 to 20 minutes, and we'll take questions then after each speaker's presentation, and again at the end if there are any additional questions. So our first speaker will be Dr. Jonathan Grothy from Concordia Seminary, where he's an associate professor of exegetical theology. He graduated from Concordia Seminary in 1966. He earned the MDiv, the Master's of Sacred Theology, and the PhD from Concordia in 1966, 67, and 81, respectively. He studied at the University of Tübingen in Germany from 1967 to 1970. From 1971 to 79, he served as pastor of Lutheran churches in Minnesota and California, as well as being a part-time high school instructor. He served at Concordia Seminary St. Louis as guest instructor in the summers of 1980 and 81, and has been a member of the faculty there since 1981. He was a Fulbright Fellow at the Eberhard Karls University in Tübingen, West Germany, from 1967 until 69, and the CFW Walter Fellow at Concordia Seminary from 1979 to 81. And Dr. Grothy will speak to us today on disorderliness and Gnosticism. Dr. Grothy?
Among the Gnostics, do the Church Fathers describe? Now, if I were reading what I'm laying before you in an article, I probably at this point would page to the end. I suspect a lot of you would see, well, what did he come up with for answers? So, for your benefit, I'm going to do the same thing and read a couple of sentences out of my conclusions so that as we meander through the stuff here, you might have an idea of where it's going. Listening to what church fathers say about Gnostic practices makes us aware of some antinomian behavior in Gnostic groups. Analysis of the Gnostic ideology could lead to the hypothesis that disorderliness, to live in defiance of this world's social, economic, political structures, would be a logical principle of Gnostic ethics, derived from its anti-cosmic dualism. But an examination of Gnostic sources, along with a more careful consideration of the Christian and pagan references to Gnostic behavior, counsels caution. An ideologically grounded rebellious disorderliness as a principle of Gnostic ethics does not, in fact, appear to be widespread. So that's where we're heading, and we want to look at a few things. Various Christian writers in the first few centuries made charges concerning behavior prevalent in Gnostic sects. A perusal of the descriptions of the pertinent passages of the early fathers uncovers testimony to the following. I have six items. An antinomian principle expressed before the end of the first century. Objections to the Gnostics' eating of meat offered to idols. Promiscuous Gnostic practices violating the sanctity of marriage. A commitment to libertinism on principle among some Gnostics. The lack of ecclesiastical discipline and order in some Gnostic communities of the second century, and reprehensible excesses in cultic practices of some second century sects. So, to recite a couple of probably fairly well-known passages, Irenaeus begins with what he considers the root of the heresy, Simon Magus, of whom he says, the prophets, they say, spoke their prophecies under the inspiration of the angels who made the world. Therefore, those who have set their hope on Simon and Helen, pay no further attention to them, that is the words of the prophets, and do what they wish as free agents. From Menander, Simon's disciple, Irenaeus says, two further disciples branched out into different directions, Saturninus, a stringent ascetic, but on the other hand, of Basilides and his followers, Irenaeus says that they, like Simon, hold that the prophecies, that is, of the Old Testament, were spoken by the world-making principalities and the law by their chief, the one who led the people out of the land of Egypt. They despise meats sacrificed to idols and regard them as nothing and use them without any hesitation. They have an indifferent use of other actions and of universal lust. We should note also that the likes of Simon and Menander, Justin Martyr also links Marcion and his followers, referring to shameful deeds about which stories are told, the upsetting of the lamp, promiscuous intercourse, meals of human flesh. But it is to Carpocrates and his followers, a sect that flourishes around 130, that Irenaeus attributes antinomianism on principle and a necessary libertinism. The soul of Jesus, Irenaeus allegedly said, was brought up lawfully in Jewish customs, but despised them, and therefore received powers through which it annihilated the passions which are attached to men and punishment. And the Carpocratians claim to do the same. Irenaeus continues, they have reached such a pitch of madness that they say it is in their power to do whatever is irreligious and impious, for they say that actions are good and bad only in accordance with human opinion. In the transmigrations into bodies, souls ought to experience every kind of life and action, if in a single life on earth any one of ones for all in equal completeness, so that according to what their writings say, their souls which have been involved in every experience may not, when they depart, still suffer any lack. They must act in such a way that they will not be forced into another body if something is still lacking in their freedom. In another passage about the last great Gnostic sect of the second century, Irenaeus characterizes the way of life of the perfect and the pneumatics among the Valentinians. Fearlessly practicing everything that is forbidden in Holy Scripture, they eat with indifference food offered to idols, thinking that they are not in any way defiled thereby. They are the first to arrive at any festival party of the heathen that takes place in honor of idols, while some of them do not even avoid the murderous spectacle of fights with beasts and single combats which are hateful to God and man. And some who are immoderately given over to the desires of the flesh say that they are only repaying to the flesh what belongs to the flesh, and to the spirit what belongs to the spirit. In another vein, Tertullian criticizes a different sort of lack of order among the Gnostics, in a passage which I will excerpt a couple of sentences from First Corinthians Heretics. In the first place, one does not know who is a catechumen, who is a believer. They meet with one another in the house or assembly, listen to one another, and pray with one another. Even if pagans approach them, they throw that which is holy to dogs and pearls, though they be false before swine. They wish abandonment of discipline to be taken for simplicity. And further down about the possibilities of advancement, nowhere is there easier advancement than in the camp of the rebels, where even to be there is a merit. In this way, one man is bishop today, another tomorrow. Today one is deacon, who tomorrow will be reader. Today a priest, who tomorrow will be a layman. For even to laymen, they commit priestly duties. Finally, we take note of the fact that Epiphanius has given a description of the unconventional sexual practices with which certain Barbelo-Gnostic groups conclude their love feasts. Practices so unseemly, I shall forego the recitation of them. Some say that Epiphanius is misinformed or exaggerating. Others say it must be an eyewitness account. Be that all as it may, I take it as some corroboration that there is a denunciation of quite similar practices in Epistis Sophia. And so it's not all made up out of thin air, probably. So, the manifestations of disorderliness among the Gnostics, according to early Christian sources, focus on the rejection of the Old Testament Jewish law, indifference, especially as regards meat offered to idols, sexual promiscuity, lack of church discipline and ecclesiastical orders, and excessive sexual aberrations in the cults. We set beside this now a picture, a summary of what can be theorized based on the primary sources about disorderliness and Gnostic ethics. How am I doing terrible on time? First passage to which I direct our attention is a Gnostic defense of libertinism on somewhat philosophical grounds, written according to tradition by Epiphanes, son of Carpocrates, preserved in a long quotation in Clement of Alexander's Stromatitis III. The justice of God, or righteousness of God, he says, is kind of sharing along with equality. And this is all based or is evidenced in the fact that stars and sun and sunlight are available equally to all. Nature and natural productivity are regulated by no law. All beings begin and give birth alike, having received by justice an innate quality. But arrive the evil lawgivers, who establish laws and thereby also transgression of laws, and the ideas of mine and thine crept in, though through the laws which cause the earth money and even marriage no longer to bring forth fruit for common use. For man, God made all things to be common property. He brought the female to be with the male in common, and in the same way united all the animals. He thus showed righteousness to be a universal sharing along with equality. But those who have been born in this way have denied the sharing, which is the corollary of their origin, and say, let him who has taken one woman keep her, whereas all can share her, just as the animal shows. With a view to the permanence of the race, he has implanted in males a strong and ardent desire, which neither law nor custom nor any other restraint is able to destroy. Consequently, one must understand the saying, thou shalt not desire, as if the lawgiver was making a jest. To which he added the even more comic words, thy neighbor is goods. For he himself who gave the desire to sustain the race orders that it is to be suppressed, though he removes it from no other animals. And by the words, thy neighbor's wife, he says something even more ludicrous, since he forces what should be common property to be treated as a private possession. End of quote. Now, this argument is neither very scientific, nor is it carried through to its full consequence. The focus of these words appears to be rather strongly on the matter of males having access to other men's wives, and little is really said about private property being everyone's for the takings or any other possible practical applications of the principle. But the treatment of this passage by Kurt Rudolph in his fine book on gnosis is kind of interesting. He speaks of it as a sort of, if I may, manifesto of Gnostic communism, and he mentions a 6th century AD Iranian movement which made use of Gnostic and Mandean concepts of communism. The author of this fragment, therefore, he says, shows the latent disruptive force in the Gnostic view of life. Those words are very suggestive to me as I pursue this topic. First, when analyzed theoretically, there is a disruptive force, a disorderliness in the Gnostic view of life. That disruptive force is latent, except for a few possible sporadic manifestations in isolated sects and areas of life. With a nod in the direction of Hans Jonas, Rudolph agrees that libertinism is the form of expression of Gnostic morality which applies to the pneumatics, because it expressed in the best way possible their self-esteem and sense of freedom from every kind of cosmic coercion. This moral principle can be seen to have been rooted in an ethic which is consistent with the Gnostic ideology. He says, gnosis, concentration on the world above and the unworldly nucleus of man bound up with it, radically severs any connection with this world and society, and focuses attention on the individuals who are hostile to the world as the central subject and object of concern. In terms of consequences for outward behavior, morality, he says, the rejection of the creation and the simultaneous appeal to the possession of celestial knowledge led to a rejection of the conventional conceptions of morality. The well-known alternatives are amoral libertinism or asceticism. Either, he says, represents a revolution on a moralistic plane. Rudolph's fine chapter on the nature and structure of gnosis documents that an anti-cosmic dualism is at the core of Gnostic spirituality. The cosmos is the fullness of evil. The chosen, the redeemed, the sons of light, the aliens are free, free from Jewish law, free from all conventions and laws of man and this world's creators. This leads to a self-concept on the part of the free, redeemed Gnostic, which could become either extremely hostile or indifferent towards the orders of this world's social structures. This leads either to a total withdrawal or to an utterly indifferent assimilation and compromise. Rudolph theorizes then further on our subject and know his confession and he cannot find explicit Gnostic statements illustrating what he's talking about. The view of the world and history held by Gnosis, as we have depicted it, and I think he's depicted it well, contains a criticism of all existing things which hardly finds its counterpart in antiquity. The rejection of the creation, together with its creator, and the degrading and demonizing of the celestial spheres, the stars and the planets, necessarily include a disapprobation and denial of the social-political world generated by antiquity. This aspect of the Gnostic revolt against the prevailing secular and religious system is not, however, stated explicitly. The reason for this, Rudolf suggests, is the Gnostics' utter indifference towards the present world. They had no interest at all in social reform, no criticism of the Roman period. Nonetheless, Rudolf claims to find, though it's not laid out explicitly, a few allusions to the socio-critical views of the Gnostics over against their environment. One, probably the leading point of evidence that he has for these allusions comes from, for example, the Apocalypse of Adam and the Treatise on the Origin of the World, the references of the perfect Gnostics to themselves as a kingless race, who are already kings as immortal within the mortal realm. They will pass judgment on the gods of chaos and their powers. Now whether, see, just in that, which I think is probably to be understood strictly in a religious sense, with regard to salvation and freedom from the powers, whether there is a social criticism or a politically dangerous statement in that is questionable.